From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When David Johansen and the band the New York Dolls formed in the 70s, he said they wanted to create an explosion of excitement, and they did. A few years ago, the pre-punk band reunited. Now they have their first new recording in 30 years. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with David Johansen. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film Miami Vice, based on the popular TV show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest is musician and actor David Johansen. He was a founding member and frontman for the early 70s glam band The New York Dolls. Later, in his lounge lizard persona of Buster Poindexter, Johansen had the hit Hot, Hot, Hot. The Dolls formed in 1971. They were one of the first straight bands to dress glam. They wore lipstick, eye makeup, platform heels, and sexually ambiguous clothes. In a recent New York Times profile, Will Hermes wrote, "For a band that effectively lasted 3 years, made 2 records, and achieved but a dusting of fame, the Dolls' Do Something Spirit left a huge platform-booted imprint on rock history. Their sound was loud and rough, and as the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll says, they set the stage for the punk movement that followed 5 years later." 2 years ago, Johansen and the other surviving members of the New York Dolls reunited for a festival in England. Initially conceived as a one-time reunion, that performance led to other shows and a new studio recording, their first in over 3 decades. It's called One Day It Will Please Us to Remember Even This. Terry spoke with David Johansen in 2004. Before we hear their conversation, here's Dance Like a Monkey from the New Dolls CD. You designed so intelligent.
David Johansen, welcome back to Fresh Air. You want to tell the story of how Morrissey invited you to reunite the band and or the surviving members of the band and do this concert?
Well, when he was a kid, he was the president of the Dolls fan club. And so I've had a couple of run-ins with him over the years. And so he wasn't, you know, a total stranger to me. So he called me up and, you know, so I wasn't, like, shocked that he called me because sometimes he asks me what a word in a song means or something. He's kind of like a dollsologist, and usually I have no idea what he's talking about. But he proposed this, what is it called? The Meltdown Festival. And every year in London they have this, I don't know how long it lasts, 2 weeks or something, and they get some English rock and roll star to curate it. And he asks, you know, his favorite groups or singers or acts or whatever. I mean, it could be a ventriloquist, it could be anything. So he asked me to do this. And when he asked it to, it was the last thing on my mind. You know, it was the furthest thing from my mind. So I was like, I don't think so. And he was like, oh, please, please, please. And you know, I said to him, would you do that with your old group? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, aha! But then, you know, it was really something I never considered doing because of, you know, Johnny, who I thought was, like, essential to the whole thing, Johnny Thunders, being in Woodlawn or wherever he lives. So I said, you know, let me sleep on it because I had been going through this phase, I think I'm kind of still in it, where I don't want to reject things out of hand, you know, that kind of like been there, done that, let's do something else kind of thing. I just want to give things a little more consideration. So I considered it, and I thought, you know, it'd be great to get together with the cats and play a little and have a couple of laughs. And so I acquiesced the next day, I think, or the day after that.
So when you were on stage, you know, with the with the Reunited and the new version of the Dolls, and you were doing the old Doll songs. Did you have any like flashbacks to things that you had totally forgotten about? Like, did memories like surface of things that were really interesting that you had completely forgotten about until you were back in that setting again?
Well, I have memories, but God, they're vague, you know. I remember the first time we made a record with Todd Rundgren, and the only thing I remember is the lights on the control board. I thought they were really pretty.
Mm.
And that's really the only memory I
Any
have.
Any historian would want to know all about that.
Of making that first record. That's the, you know, people think I'm kidding when they ask, well, what was it like making that first record? Because it, you know, kind of became this benchmark kind of record.
Mm-hmm,
but that's really the only memory I have of it. But, you know, the thing that struck me was I had to kind of sit down and listen to the music and write the words down and learn them. And
oh, you had
I
to relearn
thought,
your own songs?
Yeah, because, you know, I hadn't sung them mm-hmm. in God knows how long, you know. I mean, it wasn't like I had to relearn them from scratch because they kind of come back to you, but I had to have some kind of thing to look at. And, you know, I find that when I write something, it goes into my head better than if I mm-hmm. just try to memorize it. So I was writing, for example, like Human Being, and I was thinking, God, how did I write that song? This is great. I mean, it really holds up, you know. It's kind of like a declaration that I think is timeless. So there's a lot of stuff like that in the songs, which, let me explain something to you. There was a time, you know, when we started the Dolls and we were really such a gang and it was like us against the world and we were really trying to evolve music into something new and it was, you know, very kind of almost militant to us. And then over the years, you know, in the history books, you know, like the Rolling Stone Complete Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll or something, you know, you go into Coliseum and sit down and you look in the appendix and see where your name is and see what they say about you. It's not like you buy the book. And they would always say, you know, they were trashy, they were flashy, they were drug addicts, they were drag queens, you know. And that whole kind of trashy blah, blah, blah thing, I think over the years kind of settled in my mind as, oh yeah, that's what it was, you know? And then by going back to it and deconstructing it and then putting it back together again, I realized that, you know, it really is art and that some critic at one time had come up with this catch-all phrase that, as you know, once somebody says it, then everybody just looks it up and they say it because nobody does.
Right.
Nobody has an original idea.
In spite of the fact that you don't remember a whole lot about parts of the early days of the Dolls, do you remember writing the song Personality Crisis?
Well, you know, I don't remember exactly sitting down and writing the words, but I remember where I got the name because I was kind of like an acolyte in Charles Ludlam's Ridiculous Theater when I was a kid. This is when I was, you know, 17, 18, 19. And
let's just describe what Charles Ludlam's theater was. He used to dress and drag a lot as the leading lady and these like Greta Garbo kind of roles. And
yeah, but it was so much more than that. It was really very intelligent stuff that he used to do, and he used to combine a lot of genres of, you know, classical playwriting and, you know, like Molière he would put in with something kitschy that was present, you know, present day stuff, and he would make this melange of ideas that were just so, they would come out so original and brilliant that, you know, people throw the word genius around, but he was actually a genius. He was one of the most intelligent people I think I've ever met. But I think one day we were at a rehearsal or something, and he just said, oh, God, I'm having a personality crisis. And I just thought, oh, that's really good. And I wrote it down, you know, personality crisis. And that's really all I remember about writing a song, and the song came from that.
Well, why don't we hear Personality Crisis as performed by the New York Dolls at the Meltdown Festival over the summer. So this is from the new CD, and there's a DVD version of this too, The Return of the New York Dolls.
The New York Dolls with frontman David Johansen. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with David Johansen. The New York Dolls have just released a new CD. A 2004 reunion performance recorded at a British music festival was also released on CD and DVD.
In the liner notes for the DVD and the CD, you write about Arthur Kane. This was his last performance. He was the bass player of the band, and it was Arthur Kane who knocked on your door and recruited you to be in the Dolls when the band was being formed. He died just a few weeks after the concert. Did you even know he was sick?
No, and neither did he. He had this incredible life, Arthur, and actually a friend of his is making a documentary about it as we speak, and I guess it'll come out sometime and people can get an idea of what his life was like. He was just this really brilliant guy who had this incredible insight into reality that was it was just one step to the left of probably the most radical people I had ever met at that point. And I don't even mean politics, I just mean the way he saw things, and they were always spot on, and he was just so brilliant to me. And then he kind of He had been come from this family that was just like hell on earth, and he got a taste for the booze and went through like a lot of years of just being drunk all the time. And I remember he got to this point where you would just say hi, Arthur, and he would just say woof. His only word became woof. Anyway, he went through all this stuff. I mean, I can't begin to tell you. In his life, he fell out a window. He did this. He got hit by a car. He did this. He did that. And then he came out the other side, and he got involved with, like, the Mormons, and became the librarian at the family history office at the Mormon Tabernacle. And He was like this Mormon, but with this really kind of demented outlook on life. So he wasn't, like a proselytizer. When I saw him again, he said, I'm not a proselytizing Mormon. But he just was so wonderful. And I can't explain to you what kind of a guy he was, because there's no one you can compare him to.
He
had this very high voice. And he was 6'5" or something.
Let's talk about how he did recruit you for the band. He knocked on your door in your apartment in Manhattan. You were, around 19 or something?
Yeah.
What did he tell you about this new band?
Well, there was a guy who lived in my building who I used to kind of, jam with and strum guitars. And he was this Colombian guy who played bongos. And we used to just sit around and play music. And he knew Billy Mercia, who was the original drummer in the Dolls. And told these guys that who were looking for a singer that I was a singer, and he thought I was a pretty good singer. And so one day, Arthur was just at my door with Billy, and Arthur was about 3 feet taller than Billy, and he just said, I hear you're a singer. And I said, yeah, and I invited them in, and we started talking, and they said they had a band, and they were looking for a singer, and I was looking for a band, and we just, really that day, actually, we left my apartment and went like 4 blocks up the street to Johnny Thunder's apartment, where there was some drums and guitars and stuff, and started to play, and we were a band, essentially.
What were some of the things that you knew you didn't want to be about, the kind of music that you thought had dead-ended?
Oh, you know, at that time, there was like these interminable drum solos, and you know what happens when the drum solo stops. It's the worst. It's then the bass takes a solo. And stuff like that, you know? And we just wanted to kind of have some really wham-bam songs. And I mean, for me, the whole thing was like, if you have to compare it to something like a Little Richard kind of presentation. And I can remember when I was really young and I would go to the Murray the K shows, you know, and I saw Mitch Ryder. And, you know, these shows had 30 acts and everybody would come out and do 2 or 3 minutes. And Mitch Ryder would come out and do a medley of his 3 big hits. He would come out in like kind of like a tuxedo, and within 45 seconds he was half naked and sweating like a pig. And we just wanted to make an explosion, you know, of excitement. So that's what was missing, you know. Rock and roll had become very kind of pedantic and meandering, and it was looking for something, but it was like an actor in search of a play or something, you know.
Now on the album cover of the New York Dolls, you're all dressed in this kind of trashy drag with a lot of eye makeup and lipstick. You're wearing a bouffant wig. I assume it's a wig.
No, it wasn't a wig.
It wasn't a wig?
No.
You teased your hair for it? Well,
somebody teased it,
right. And you're wearing what looks like capri pants and high-heeled clogs, an open cardigan revealing your bare chest. And you're staring at yourself in the mirror of a makeup compact.
Right.
And the band's name is written in lipstick.
Right.
For those of us who didn't get to see you on stage, how did that compare with how you actually looked on stage?
Well, that was probably, you know, I mean, I think, you know, to the average civilian, it probably didn't look any different. But to us, we were like dressing up a little bit more, make it a little special for the for the record cover, you know. You know, Sylvain was in the rag trade with Billy. They had this little sweater company and called Truth. They sold it to this company called Truth and Soul. They used to make these poor boy sweaters. They had a loom, and through that, they knew a lot of people who actually are very kind of famous designers now, but who were just getting started. And I think it was like Betsy Johnson and these women that she used to work with. They had a store in St. Mark's Place, and they knew a photographer, and they knew a makeup guy, and they knew this and that. You know, we didn't know anything about that. So I think they helped to facilitate that photo session.
What inspired your interest in or willingness to be in a kind of drag for performances? I mean, you mentioned you had been with Charles Ludlam's Ridiculous Theater, and drag was often a part of their performances in theater. So where did you see it fitting into your music?
Well, you know, the hotbed of revolution at that time was, you know, St. Mark's Place and Second Avenue. And through that, you know, there were so many artists there and, you know, actors and people who were doing these plays, like the Ridiculous people. And there was, you know, filmmakers and poets and painters. And we were the band of that crowd. I mean, it wasn't like we were the band of even New York City, you know. We were the band, basically, of the East Village, you know. And it wasn't so much like a sexual thing, because, you know, like sexuality refers to like biological aspects. It was more like a gender thing, you know. And gender is like, you know, like the cultural differences that grow up around the biological differences. So instead of like male and female, like gender is really masculine and feminine, right? I think the trick for us at the time was to decide which characteristics were sex and which were gender, you know? And, you know, because there's certain things males do and there's certain things females do. I mean, the universe didn't make two sexes for nothing.
Did a lot of people early on assume that you were gay because of the way you dressed in performance or because of the
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it was obviously we weren't gay. I mean, you know, but maybe to some people it was, you know. Uh-huh. You know how some people, I mean, to some people everybody's gay, you know. Like, you could say, like, you could be talking to somebody and go, oh, that Hitler. And they go, gay. You know, so, I mean, some people just think everybody's gay. But I don't know. We were like these kind of street kids from... you know, from St. Mark's Place, you know, and we just had this idea that, you know, at the time, masculine meant strong and assertive, feminine meant weak and demure, and this was a time of, like, redefinition of the roles, you know, it was uh-huh, overdue, uh-huh. And it was just part of evolution, I think, you know, and everything kind of transcends and... goes beyond what went before, and otherwise, what's the use of doing anything, you know?
David Johansen speaking with Terry Gross. Their conversation continues in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, getting arrested on stage in Memphis and creating the persona of Buster Poindexter. We continue our conversation with David Johansen of the New York Dolls. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Miami Vice, based on the hit TV series. Cut it!
Well, the problem with troglodytes, everybody loves a fight. Give me love and turn on.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest musician and actor David Johansen was a founding member and frontman for the early 70s glam band The New York Dolls. The surviving members of the band have reunited and released their first recording in three decades. It's called One Day It Will Please Us to Remember Even This. Terry spoke to David Johansen in 2004.
Let me ask you about a couple of bands and what your first reaction was when you heard them or saw them and how that affected you. Let's start with Mick Jagger, since, you know, I think you've been very influenced by him, particularly the early Rolling Stones stuff. So what was your first reaction seeing the Stones, seeing Jagger?
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
You mean like on Ed Sullivan or something?
Or Hollywood Palace. Did you see that one?
I thought they were great, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I thought they were so cool, you know, and I liked their music, you know, because I think probably the first record I ever bought when I was a kid was like Lightnin' Hopkins and Muddy Waters and music like that. So I think when the Rolling Stones came out and they were playing that kind of music, I thought like, oh, white people can play this music? You know,
okay.
It was a revelation to me.
The Shangri-Las, what did you first think when you heard or saw them?
Well, that's kind of like a camp thing. I mean, you know, the Shangri-Las were like the ultimate girl group. I mean, you know, you take the Ronettes and the Shirelles and on and on and on. And they were actually making, you know, real music. Whereas the Shangri-Las were kind of like a cartoon, you know. And I just loved that aspect about them. And I mean, you know, they couldn't sing and I don't know. But they had these songs that, you know, Shadow Martin would dig up for them that were these just perfect kind of teen mellers, you know, as they say in Variety, like these melodramas that the first time I saw them, I just thought they were such a hoot. And I thought they were perfect. Let's put it that way. I mean, I thought this cannot be improved upon. This is the height of pop kind of fun and drama and everything, sex, everything rolled into one. It was just...
Okay. Now, their most famous song is probably Leader of the Pack, but the Dolls did a cover of Give Him a Great Big Kiss, but it was Give Her a Great Big Kiss when you did it.
And on the DVD, on the new DVD, we do another one. Which one is it? It's not You Can Never Go Home Anymore. Out in the Streets we do. You know that one?
Yeah.
Don't hang around with the gang no more. Yeah. We always do a Shangri-La song. It's just a superstition.
Well, I thought we'd go back to 1973 for this one and hear Give Her a Great Big Kiss. This is
all right.
Really a lot of fun. Okay, let's hear it. Here it is. The band was originally used to performing in Manhattan in the Village, where people like knew the band. The people who came were a part of the same like arts subculture that the band was a part of. But when you went on the road in America, did you start playing in places where people weren't kindred spirits in the same way, and they didn't necessarily get what you were doing and didn't know how to react to it?
Yes and no. I mean, it's very interesting. Like, you know, there were like Rust Belt places, you know, like Detroit and Cleveland and places like that, people would go crazy for us. And they would come to the shows all dressed up, you know, and Chicago. And, you know, we were really well received in Los Angeles and San Francisco. And we used to play a lot in Florida, you know, Miami. And we used to play in Atlanta and be very well accepted. And then we used to also, you know, we were friends with Leonard Skinner at the time. We were kind of kindred spirits, and we would go on tours of like state fairs and like tertiary markets in Missouri together, and we would have a great time. You know, I know in Memphis I got arrested on stage one night for allegedly, you know, it was like the Alice Tully Hall of Memphis. I mean, it was this nice, clean room, and there had been articles in the newspaper that we were coming to Pied Piper, all the children to the end of the world or whatever. And we thought it was funny when we read it, but I actually got arrested on stage and
what for?
Went to the Huskow in Memphis, which is, I was dressed like Liza Minnelli at the time, so it wasn't the most relaxing night I ever had.
How do people respond to you in prison?
In jail?
Yeah.
I just like hid under these like Lysol smelling like army blankets, and then this guy woke up and he went like, "Oh damn, you're David Johansen." And I was like, "Quiet, quiet, quiet." And then he woke up this bear, and the bear was growling, and I was like, "Oh my God," my knees were like, you know, rattling under these covers. But I got bailed out at like dawn.
What were the charges?
Inciting a riot. The cops, you know, the cops wanted to mess the thing up, and they started beating on kids, and because they got up and danced, and I stopped the music, and I started explaining to this officer that this child he was abusing may be, you know, the mayor's kid or nephew or something, and his job would be in jeopardy. And then they just threw me in cuffs and dragged me away for inciting a riot. I may not have used the exact same language.
Right, I understand. why did the New York Dolls break up?
Inertia. I don't know. You know, I think we got to a point where I like to think, you know, it was a project that we finished, but there was like factions in the group that were, you know, more interested in drugs than in playing music, and it just kind of became, for me, I mean, I can only speak for myself, you know, it for me it became untenable.
What did you think when you saw the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, your band, the Dolls preceded punk, but it was certainly influential in a lot of punk bands and had the same sensibility in a lot of ways. So when you saw that sensibility just really become so popular, what did you think?
I thought every new idea begins as heresy and winds up as superstition. I think I never saw the Sex Pistols, but I saw the Ramones because they used to rehearse down the hall from me. I forget what if I was in the Dolls or in the my next band, but I remember Joey Ramone came to the room I was rehearsing in. You know, they have these buildings in New York with 100 bands playing at once. It's like it would drive a monk insane. And he came by and said that he wanted me to come down the hall and hear his band. And I went down the hall to hear his band. And I probably said, you know, "You're a nice guy. Why don't you just give up?" You know, I told the Talking Heads they should give up. I mean, I would be the worst A&R man in the history of show business because I tell all these bands who were in the beginning that you're a good kid. Why don't you get a real job and a house? You know, so I don't. What do I know? I didn't think anything about it being influenced by me or anything like that. It was just probably I had a headache and the music was really loud.
David Johansen, one of the founding members of the New York Dolls, speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with David Johansen. The New York Dolls have just released a new CD, their first studio recording in over 30 years.
I want to skip ahead to the 80s and 90s when you performed a lot as Buster Poindexter. And, you know, the New York Dolls were so into a kind of pre-punk sensibility and were very high energy and very raw. And, you know, Buster Poindexter is much more of a kind of lounge, more Vegas oriented kind of persona, you know, instead of in drag on the cover, you know, the Buster Poindexter character is in a tuxedo. And
it's all drag, Terry.
Well, that's the thing. No, but that's exactly the thing.
You know, I mean, Birkenstocks are drag.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
everyone
exactly.
Is like, everybody is saying something with their clothes, you know.
So have you always felt like you were standing back and knowing that any kind of drag that you were putting on, any kind of outfit or whatever you were putting on for a performance was always that you always knew it was some kind of drag or another?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the thing with Poindexter's, there was a little club, like a saloon, an Irish bar around the corner from my house. I was living in Gramercy Park. It was two blocks from my house, and it was kind of like my watering hole. And they would have bands there like Joe Turner or Charles Brown or Big Maybell, and they would do residencies there. So they would play like three or four nights a week for a month, say, you know, and there was a room upstairs where they would live. Monday night, the back room was dark, so I had decided I was going to do this little, like, roadhouse show where I could just sing whatever songs I wanted to sing, and I was going to do it for four Mondays. And I went in there, and I figured I'd use a pseudonym so people wouldn't be coming in screaming for, you know, Funky Butt Cheek. I went in to do that, and I just picked whatever songs. I had been listening to a lot of Jump Blues at the time, but I also did, you know, like the Seven Deadly Virtues from Camelot and, you know, whatever songs I wanted to sing. And by the end of 4 weeks, I started doing weekends, and it just kind of organically built into this. It started out as a three-piece band and wound up as like a 15-piece band. So I think by the time it got to the national awareness, it did have this kind of Vegas-y kind of idea to it, but it started off more kind of like the Louis Prima days in the 50s of Vegas, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, that image was encouraged, like on the cover of the Buster Poindexter album, you're drinking a martini.
Right.
In a tuxedo right. With your pinky raised.
And then I was back on, see, I was walking to work, I was making a nice living, and mm-hmm. then we had a hit, and you know, we all went to hell because we had to go back on the road.
Right. Well, I want to play something from the Buster Poindexter era. And
don't play Hot, Hot, Hot.
No, I wasn't going to. I was going to play...
Thank God.
Were you really tired of it?
It's the bane of my life.
Oh. I was going to play Bad Boy.
Okay.
Tell me why you recorded this. This is a cover.
Well, I don't know. It's just a good song. It was written by Lil Armstrong. And I always liked it ever since I was a kid.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's hear it. This is from the Buster Poindexter album.
All dressed up in fancy clothes, I'm taking the trouble. You know that old hot blazing sun, it ain't gonna hurt my head, 'cause you always gonna find me right there in the shade. I can see all the folks, I can see they all laughing at me.
Bad Boy from David Johansen's album Buster Poindexter. David Johansen is my guest, and his first band, the New York Dolls, has a reunion CD. It seems to me that you've had so many different characters you've inhabited as a performer, and I'm wondering how much you think your career as an actor has come into play in your career as a musician. You know, because before you were even in the New York Dolls, you were with the Ridiculous Theater Company in New York, and over the years you've been in, you know, a lot of movies as well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's a lot of a kind of acting involved. I have this friend, Elliot Murphy, who's a singer. He lives in Paris now. And I remember when I started doing Buster Poindexter, he used to say to me, David, you know, Buster Poindexter is so much more like you than David Johansen is, you know, if you get what I'm saying. In other words, with Buster, I really kind of went on stage and really didn't edit myself and just kind of said whatever came to my mind and didn't have many filters. Whereas prior to that, in the period of my, I guess you would call it solo career, although, you know, you're always in a band, so it's never really a solo career, but I had the David Johansen group or band or whatever it was called, and we used to open for a lot of bands and hockey rinks, you know, and you kind of go out there. At that point, I was going out there and kind of presenting this, what I thought, like, ideal picture of myself, you know what I mean? Just this pleasant fellow, you know, whereas Buster was really kind of more warts and all, you know, and I think by doing that, it helped me to be myself more, you know, whereas so now when I go on stage, I'm not like biting my nails, like, oh, what am I going to do? What are we, how am I going to be? Blah, blah, blah. I just don't even think about it because I'm just going to go out there and essentially be whoever I am at that moment. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you once said back in the Buster Poindexter era, Buster can have this great life in the public eye and take the rap for everything, and then David can go home.
Exactly. You know, it's funny because my mother, when Buster came out, she said, you know, this is the most genius idea you've ever come up with. This is great. And I think that was her idea that, you know, Buster can take the rap, and politicians should do it.
Now, you have a show on Sirius, which is one of the satellite radio stations.
Oh, yeah.
Who are you as a DJ? Are you just yourself, or do you have a...
I have a show called The Mansion of Fun.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of like Sri Rama Poindexter Johansen. And I'm very taken with Sri Ramakrishna lately because I read a biography of his and thought, man, that guy knew how to live. And he called the planet the Mansion of Fun. So I've named my show after that. And I play a really diverse bunch of music. You know, I play salsa, opera, blues, rock and roll, you know, you name it. I play a lot of Nino Rota music. I play, you know, whatever tickles my fancy. So it's really completely free form, and I speak a lot of kind of Ken Wilber type forward thinking philosophy.
Well, David Johansen, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Johansen of the New York Dolls. Their new album is called One Day It Will Please Us to Remember Even This. The Dolls will be performing at 7 p.m. tonight at the Tower Records on the Sunset Strip in L.A. A U.S. tour is in the works.
I was sitting there all alone. I was praying you would come home. I was listening to an old blues song.
Coming up, David Edelstein on the movie version of Miami Vice. This is Fresh Air. powerboat streaking across blue water, moody visuals, vice cops in cool, expensive suits. It can only be the return of Miami Vice, now a movie written and directed by the TV show's creator, Michael Mann. Can it work in 2006 the way it did in the mid-80s? Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
In the early 80s, the late network executive Brandon Tartikoff handed the writer-director Michael Mann a piece of paper that read, MTV Cops. The series that came of that notion, Miami Vice, was a cunning mixture of the torrid and the torpid, which is to say, hard action and harder lovemaking amid a lot of woozy posturing. Well, it wasn't entirely posturing. Mann's protagonists are so single-minded that lasting relationships are impossible. The hero, Sonny Crockett, longs for a connection, finds it fleetingly, but is invariably left alone with his expensive clothes. Ah, those clothes. I remember in the 80s donning a pastel t-shirt under a light suit and thinking myself a very cool fellow indeed. In Mann's new motion picture, Colin Farrell as Crockett and Jamie Foxx as Rico Tubbs aren't sleek pretty boys like their predecessors Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas. Their suits are roomy to accommodate their pumped-up physiques. And the look is rougher than the old shows. It's swervy, jittery, with a lot of video grain. But the all-important Miami Vice vibe endures. Although the rumor mill had it that this over-budget film was a disaster, I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. Mann does nothing so mundane as introduce the characters of Crockett and Tubbs the way he did in the TV pilot. He simply plops the duo down in mid-story. When a friend of the detectives dies gruesomely after running afoul of some sneering neo-Nazi drug dealers, Crockett and Tubbs and their team of multiracial male and female cops are drafted by the feds to pose as drug smugglers, and they whiz off to Haiti to meet with the neo-Nazis' Colombian suppliers. Their act is prodigious, and what follows is scene after scene of macho glowering, of violent men sizing one another up, scanning their adversaries' faces for signs of duplicity or weakness, while at the same time they engage in a dizzying back and forth over the minutiae of drug smuggling. Here's Tubbs and then Crockett in a test of wills with the number two cartel bad guy, a little sadist called Yero, played by John Ortiz.
So let's talk equipment.
Atom A500s, carbon composite. Real stealthy, 1,400 nautical mile range, low and slow. We like caravels and 727s to move the product from source countries to transshipment places like here.
Big loads, like containers. Smaller loads into South Florida, we do go-fast boats.
So what's the weight?
First, let's talk logistics. Okay. You pick up a load, you fly it in the hole, we tell you the drop point, and our people then move it on up the road.
Not so fast. People at the drop point are our people, not yours. You know, so there's no tweakers, dopers, first-timers. People we don't know. They didn't do time with us, they ain't doing crime with us.
Once we pick up the load, the next time you hear from us, it'll be a date, time, and a place. Like, there's an 18-wheeler in the parking lot in North Miami with the keys in the ignition. You pick it up, you drive away. Smooth. That's how we do it.
Mann is great at that kind of showboat detail. But it's the drug mogul's mistress and accountant, Isabella, played by Chinese art film heartthrob Gong Li, who really grabs Crockett's attention. He catches a glimmer of vulnerability under her leggy, ice queen, ultra-competent exterior, and knows deep down she's as soft as he is. So the pair goes out for mojitos, to Havana, no less, in a boat that would make Batman gape. There isn't a lot of gunplay in Miami Vice, but there's plenty of action. Mann lingers on Fox's rippling back as Tubbs and his woman, Naomi Harris, get it on in the shower, and on Crockett and Isabella on sheets dappled with tropical sun. Mann ladles on the languorous mood rock, but elsewhere he brings an urgency to the visuals that's in keeping with his later films like Heat and Collateral. He and his cinematographer, Dion Beebe, make everything vaguely surreal. The hard horizontal lines of office buildings, the maze of tributaries off Biscayne Bay. The violence is fast and disorienting. The climactic shootout has the limited perspectives of TV's cops, and the soft pop-pop-pop of distant guns is far eerier than the usual over-amplified cannon roars. Disorientation cuts both ways, of course. As a thriller, Miami Vice is only semi-coherent, with an ending that leaves more than one thread dangling. But do we really need another familiar to the point of deja vu buddy cop movie? Even with its narrative lapses, Miami Vice is a sensational trip. Gorgeous. Gaga. Entrancing.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lily's Ghost, a novel about a mother's love and the traumas of war by Cheryl Drake Harris. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology. Capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the crisis in the Middle East with Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.